agencies have launched audits into the program and announced a sweeping suspension of companies participating in it. U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth also announced on social media last month that his department would be
taking a sledgehammer to the oldest DEI program in the federal government.
Murkowski says that Native-owned businesses participate in the program because Congress recognized the government's trust and treaty obligations to Native communities.
And that was not based on race. It was not based on DEI.
Catherine Carlton is Inupiat from Cordova and is the president of Chugach Alaska Corporation. Her organization has participated in the program for decades and has benefited from its economic opportunities.
For us, it provided the pathway to recover from the devastating Exxon Valdez oil spill in our region.
Polly Watson is vice president of operations at Bristol Bay Native Corporation and says her organization has several businesses participating in the 8A program. Watson says the corporation reinvests the revenue it receives through government contracts back into community. One example is a partnership with the State Division of Motor Vehicles to deliver mobile DMV services.
To bring real ID and driver's license services to 7 villages in the Bristol Bay region serving 544 rural residents.
Tribal leaders and senators from Nevada, Oklahoma, Montana, and Hawaii all spoke in support of the Native participation in the 8A program. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naitin.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
So glad you chose to be with us here in the KABU Evening News on this Thursday, February 12th, 2026.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings, Josh Salem, S.W. Concert, Mel Gertoff, and Isabel Charlet. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings.
Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today I'm welcoming a South African filmmaker whose work is screening at the Cascade Festival of African Films. Tara Erica Moore is the director of Legacy, Apartheid's Shadow. Tara Moore, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's see. Tell me a little bit about your film, Legacy, Apartheid's Shadow.
Yes. So Legacy, Apartheid's Shadow, it's about why South Africa is still the most unequal country in the world today, despite 31 years now of democracy. So it looks at, you know, the systemic nature of inequality to say that you can't just say, we're bringing democracy. Democracy came in 1994 in South Africa. You can't just, it's not as simple as having democracy in the laws, because the legacy, the systemic legacy remains socially, economically, and psychologically as well. And so I interviewed the grandson of the architect of apartheid. So that's a very interesting, like, human arc through the film. And he talks about to that point, how he went from being an ardent supporter of apartheid to becoming conscientized and realizing that it was wrong, and now what he's doing in present day to counter his ancestral legacy.
So, yeah, tell me a little bit more about this fellow. I was reading a little bit about him on the Cascade Festival website. So how did you meet this fellow, the grandson of the architect of apartheid? And give us a little bit of background about how that system came about.
Yeah, so his grandfather is known as the architect of apartheid, H.F. Verwoerd. You know, apartheid was at the beginning of segregation in South Africa. There was colonialism before that, but it was just the most overt and legalized version of segregation. And apartheid is basically South Africa split the country, not only between black and white, but all the different racial groups they separated. So black, white, Indian, and we have a group that is called, it's like a mixed race group, and in South Africa it's called colored. So all four, the whole country was divided into those four. Every town was reorganized so that you had racially dominated towns. And after many, many, many decades of resistance, we finally brought democracy. Democracy finally came to South Africa. And so now, you know, that was in 94. And so Wilhelm, what he's doing now, Wilhelm Verwoerd, he's the grandson of H.F. Verwoerd. And so what he is interested in is trauma research, historical trauma research. So, you know, he actually works, his whole thing is, a colleague of his said to him one day, I'm so tired of as a black woman trying to tell other people that racism exists, that racism is a problem, you know, to convince them. And she said to him, what are you doing as a white man to convince other white people that this exists and this is wrong? And so it really, it resonated with him. And so he does what he calls white work. So he does, I guess in the States we'd call it allyship, but it's more than that, because it's white people, if you've been conscientized, working with other white people to conscientize them and not putting the burden all on people of color to make people aware of the issue and the inequality and that sort of stuff.
Now, you talked about one of the legacies of apartheid being economic. The ownership of land is a huge issue. You know, in some countries, when the government changes hands, there's land reform. That hasn't been quite as effective in South Africa since apartheid was abolished.
Exactly. It's really hard, because at the end of apartheid, you have about 70% of the land being owned by 10% of the population. It's incredibly unequal. But it's not something that can be so easily changed. You can't take people's land from them. You can't, you know, so it does, this process takes a long time, is the problem. And it's because, you know, up until 1991, African people, the majority demographic in South Africa, wasn't allowed to buy land from 1913 till 1991. So of course, that is a great explanation for that earlier ratio of why so high a percent of the land is owned by so few people. And that just, the thing is, that takes time. The economic change right now, we have the highest wealth inequality. 70% of South Africa's income is taken in by only 20% of the country. 40% is making 7%. So it's just, these are sort of big numbers and big ratios that are going to take a long time to change, because there's not an easy solution.
Well, one of the things that has been making headlines in the States is this sort of canard about white South Africans being oppressed, and how the Trump administration, along with, you know, Elon Musk and others, they're planning to rescue white South Africans and bring them to the United States because they're so oppressed. How have South Africans been looking at this strange turn of events?
Well, I think internally in South Africa, it's a bit of a joke, you know, from the white community as well. I think the majority of white people know that they are not, there is no genocide against them. So it's a very small population. And I think, unfortunately, what Trump and Elon is doing is they're just propagating you know, in his terms, fake news. It's a total misrepresentation of what's happening. There is a lot of crime in South Africa, but the people that feel the crime most are African people in the townships, you know, from other African people. And so though there are a few, you know, what Trump was talking about and Elon is talking about were white farmers being attacked and sort of like targeted. And that is a very infrequent occasion. Of course, it is a huge country, things happen, but there is no, it's not so big to call it genocide. It's not so big as targeted. It's much like you would have crime anywhere, you know, but the biggest crime rates are in the African townships. So those are the people who are most vulnerable to the violence.
Now you divide your time between South Africa and the United States, and what prompted this documentary? I mean, what was it in you? Were you hoping to give a more nuanced picture of your homeland to the folks across the pond, basically?
You know, I grew up between South Africa and Connecticut. I was born in South Africa. Most of my upbringing was in South Africa. And then I went to college in Connecticut and I've been living in LA ever since. So my parents still live in South Africa and I go back every year for Christmas, New Year's, and I have friends from high school still there. And for me, this was a very personal attempt to try help change the narrative within South Africa, actually, because I felt that people in privileged circles, myself included, they weren't really aware of why things were the way they are, you know. And so I found that people were blaming a lot of the inequality and the poverty and the homelessness and the lack of employment with the last 30 years of democracy instead of putting it in context of the last 350 years of our history. And for me, it's a very dangerous point of view because it's a sort of a scapegoat to blame it on sort of the democratic government instead of understanding how we got to where we are. So for me, I hope to add to the narrative of South Africa, to change the narrative internally about why we are the way we are, because, you know, if you change the way you understand the world, it might change who you hire. It might change the way you are empathetic in your life. And those tiny changes, I think, can make all the difference.
Now, when viewers come out to see your documentary, Legacy Apartheid's Shadow, what can they expect? You're talking about history. You're talking about narratives. What sort of journey are you going to take people on? Are you going to take them through, you know, the halls of power? Are you going to take them through the townships? Take them on a journey through history? What can people expect?
You can expect a very powerful movie, which does give you a great sense of the history of South Africa, but I think speaks to some really interesting topical subjects like race as a social construct, the legacies of inequality, systemic inequality, and also activism. South Africa is a really, really great example of how the people came together and you know, we had this community-led change. And I think in the States, as you know, there are so many parallels that people draw in the States watching this film. And so, you know, in the States now, we're sort of having our own reckoning of what is going to happen. How are the people going to take back charge and in their communities? Like, what can we do on a grassroots level to help everyday sort of life?
Is this your first visit to the Cascade Festival of African Films?
Yes, it is. Yeah. I'm very excited and honored to be part of it.
So what's next for you? This film, Legacy Apartheid's Shadow, has been screening around the country. And in fact, you won the Best South African Documentary Award and were a contender for the Best Feature Documentary in the 2025 Oscar race. What's next for you?
Well, right now I'm focusing on its outreach impact tour. So I'm taking it through, we've just finished a year of the festival circuit. This will be one of the few festivals more. And then I'm taking it to the universities. So I'll do a lot of screenings and post-screening discussions at some prominent U.S. universities like Brown and Princeton and Johns Hopkins and UPenn. That starts later this month. So I'm really excited for the conversations because I do find that this film is a great catalyst for dialogue about race, about accountability, about historical legacy. And it's a great way to look at other countries and those issues there, because these are sort of blueprint issues that every country can relate to.
Now, I understand that you identify as a person of mixed race and you make your home in Los Angeles. If I may ask, what have the last few months been like in your sphere?
In Los Angeles?
Yes.
Well, honestly, I've been in South Africa for about a month. For most of Christmas, New Year's, I was back in South Africa. But, you know, I think just the... And I just work so hard. So I think I'm in a bit of a bubble in LA. So I think we're all seeing the same, I'm reading the same news as everybody. And there is an air of, it's a lot. It's a lot for everybody to take. And I think some people are feeling personally attacked and some people are turning off the news. I sometimes, it's almost too hard to watch, you know, and I think it's scary what's going on. It's horrible. It's a really dystopian time to be in the States right now.
Tara Erica Moore's documentary is called Legacy, Apartheid's Shadow. It will be screening on March 5th at 7 p.m. at PCC Cascade. And more information is available at africanfilmfest.org. Tara Erica Moore, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Conch. It was a pleasure to be here and chat with you.
I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we've been talking today about the Cascade Festival of African Films with filmmaker Tara Erica Moore. This year's Cascade Festival of African Films runs from February 6th through March 7th. Most events are taking place at the Portland Community College Cascade campus. More information can be found at africanfilmfest.org.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Israel and the U.S. disagree on the West Bank's future. Is the U.S. dealing with Russia behind Ukraine's back? And Trump talks with Xi Jinping, but their versions differ. First, Israel and the U.S. disagree on the West Bank's future. Once again, Israel's far right is pushing toward de facto annexation of the West Bank in violation of international law. The Trump administration has made clear its opposition. A White House official said that President Trump, quote, has clearly stated that he does not support Israel annexing the West Bank, saying a stable West Bank keeps Israel secure and aligns with the administration's plans for regional peace. These comments came after Israel's security cabinet approved a plan to intensify Israeli control over areas of the West Bank formerly governed by the Palestinian Authority, such as by allowing Israelis to purchase land there. We are deepening our roots in all parts of the land of Israel and burying the idea of a Palestinian state, said far-right Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich. The newspaper Haaretz reports that the Israeli police are avoiding the allocation of forces for operations against Jewish terrorism in the West Bank. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who will be visiting Trump to discuss the matter, apparently has made no effort to contain attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank. Most foreign observers agree that unless Israel stops imposing its will there, there is no hope for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. As the Washington Post reports, 8 Arab and Muslim countries, including Egypt, Jordan, Turkey, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, have accused Israel of, quote, accelerating attempts at its illegal annexation and the displacement of the Palestinian people. Is the U.S. dealing with Russia behind Ukraine's back? Many of us suspected this. Secret U.S. talks with Russia about trade and investment deals once the Ukraine war is behind them. The Washington Post reports, quote, days after negotiations to halt Russia's war in Ukraine ended inconclusively in Abu Dhabi, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that Russia and the U.S. were discussing bilateral economic agreements worth some $12 trillion, including deals that would affect Ukraine. Zelensky cited Ukraine intelligence. We already knew from earlier reporting by Axios that an economic deal with Russia was in the works, as Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner talked with Russia's Kirill Dmitriev, a close ally of Vladimir Putin. Zelensky worries that any such agreement will be at Ukraine's expense. He said, quote, some of these agreements could also involve issues related to Ukraine, for example, our sovereignty or Ukraine security. We are making it clear that Ukraine will not support any such, even potential agreements about us that are not made without us. These behind-the-scenes talks and November elections in the U.S. are putting new pressure on Ukraine to make a deal with Russia. For Russia, big economic deals with the U.S. are going to be crucial to its economy. The war has become very expensive for Russia, and reports are that its oil sales are plummeting. Next, Trump talks with Xi Jinping, but their versions differ. As happened last November, a telephone call between the two leaders was summarized by each in wildly different ways. Here's Trump, quote, it was a long and thorough call where many important subjects were discussed, including trade, military, the April trip that I will be making to China, which I very much look forward to, Taiwan, the war between Russia and Ukraine, the current situation with Iran, the purchase of oil and gas by China from the United States, the consideration by China of the purchase of additional agricultural products, including lifting the soybean count to 20 million tons for the current season. Airplane engine deliveries and numerous other subjects, all very positive. The relationship with China and my personal relationship with President Xi is an extremely good one, and we both realize how important it is to keep it that way. I believe that there will be many positive results achieved over the next 3 years of my presidency. Unquote. The Chinese version of the talks focused, just as it did last year, on Taiwan, with no mention of the other subjects cited by Trump. President Xi, says the readout, emphasized that the Taiwan question is the most important issue in China-U.S. relations. Taiwan is Chinese territory. China must safeguard its own sovereignty and territorial integrity and will never allow Taiwan to be separated. The U.S. must handle the issue of arms sales to Taiwan with prudence, unquote. That last point was in reference to the latest U.S. arms sales to Taiwan of $11 billion. According to the Chinese readout, Trump responded, quote, I understand how China feels about the Taiwan question. I would like the two sides to continue talking to each other and keep the relationship in good shape during my presidency. After the call, Trump repeated a position he has stated before. Xi, said Trump, considers Taiwan to be a part of China, and that's up to him what he's going to be doing. But, you know, I've expressed to him that I would be very unhappy if he'd attack Taiwan, and I don't think he'll do that. I hope he doesn't do that, unquote. Trump evidently believes he can talk up a big trade deal, just as happened after last year's conversation. But phone calls are not negotiations, nor are pledges made during negotiations the same as binding contracts. In other news, the U.S. accuses China of secret nuclear testing. When Donald Trump travels to China in April, he might have one military issue to add to his list of talking points, China's secret nuclear tests. His Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, Thomas DeNano, said at the U.N. Conference on Disarmament, quote, the U.S. government is aware that China has conducted secret nuclear explosive tests, including preparing for tests with designated yields in the hundreds of tons, unquote. The tests would violate the 1996 Comprehensive Nuclear Weapons Test Ban Treaty, to which the U.S. and China are signatories. DeNano cited one specific test on June 22, 2020. He raised the test issue in the context of China's expanding nuclear weapons program. It has around 300 nuclear warheads now and is estimated by the Pentagon to have 1,000 by 2030, expiration of the new START treaty with Russia, and Trump's policy statement last year that the U.S. might resume nuclear testing, quote, on an equal basis with Russia and China. Why DeNano raised a six-year-old finding is unclear, though perhaps he was trying to embarrass the Chinese, whose long-standing position on nuclear arms talks was reiterated just the other day. A foreign ministry spokesperson said that, quote, China's nuclear strength is by no means at the same level with that of the U.S. or Russia. Thus, China will not take part in nuclear disarmament negotiations for the time being, unquote. The spokesperson described the end of the New START treaty between the U.S. and Russia as truly regrettable. What would be regrettable is if the world has to wait until China reaches nuclear parity with the U.S. and Russia before sitting down to discuss limits on strategic and non-strategic weapons, as under the New START treaty. But here's another angle. China's refusal to join Moscow and Washington in nuclear talks may actually be welcome in the Trump administration, which has provided no alternative to the now abandoned treaty. As one observer writes, quote, in the blink of an eye, the U.S. went from having 5 decades of virtually uninterrupted arms control talks and deals with Russia to having none, with no new deal in sight. The president and his national security team made no meaningful statement about New START or any outward attempt towards salvaging the deal, unquote. To the contrary, Trump said his administration is considering adding to the U.S. nuclear weapon arsenal and restarting nuclear weapon testing. Russia is denied use of Starlink. Apparently acting at Ukraine's request, Starlink has blocked Russian troops' access to the internet, causing difficulties in communicating and in directing drone strikes. The New York Times reports that, quote, Russian military bloggers who track the country's armed forces were reporting frustration and communications problems on the front, where Moscow soldiers for years had used smuggled Starlink equipment to gain access to the internet, unquote. Elon Musk evidently ordered the cutoff, writing on X on February 1st, quote, looks like the steps we took to stop the unauthorized use of Starlink by Russia have worked. Let us know if more needs to be done, unquote. Ukraine's new defense minister responded with gratitude, telling Musk, quote, you are a true champion of freedom and a true friend of the Ukrainian people. The U.S. is shifting gears on Central African autocracies. The BBC reports that the U.S. has changed its policy and is now telling 3 Central African nations that have replaced French with Russian military advisors that it is now willing to work with them on security and economic issues, mainly meaning minerals extraction. Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso all experienced military coups that led their leaders to turn to Russia and reject democratic rule. Under Joe Biden, U.S. military cooperation ended with all 3. Now the State Department is following a policy line that could easily be China's or Russia's, quote, democracy is always appreciated, says a spokesman, but our policy is not to interfere in the internal affairs of other countries. People are free to choose whatever system is appropriate for them, unquote. J.D. Vance promotes trade, ignores human rights, in visits to Azerbaijan and Armenia. The vice president is making his first visit ever by a U.S. president or vice president to Azerbaijan, a country that is firmly in Russia's orbit and mimics Russia's repression of human rights and civil society. Vance is there to promote trade, following conclusion of a peace agreement last August between Azerbaijan and Armenia, which Vance also visited. There, he made a gaffe that wasn't. He laid a wreath to commemorate what he correctly called the Armenian genocide, then had the remark withdrawn to avoid offense to Turkey, whose forces killed over 1 million Armenians between 1915 and 1918. Vance blamed his staff for the supposed error. In fact, the U.S. has officially recognized the genocide in resolutions by the House and Senate in 2019 and in a statement by President Biden in 2021. Trump threatens to block the opening of a new bridge between Canada and the U.S. Donald Trump's anger over Canada's displays of independence has surfaced again, this time over a new bridge that connects Windsor and Detroit. The Gordie Howe Bridge, financed entirely by Canada but owned jointly by the governments of Canada and Michigan, is scheduled to open early this year. On Monday, Trump said he will not allow it to open in a post on Truth Social, saying Canada had treated the U.S. very unfairly for decades and that the U.S. would not benefit from the project. That's untrue, of course. The bridge is another trade route between the two countries. It's also a project Trump once hailed. Now Trump is demanding compensation, as well as the, quote, fairness and respect that we deserve. What accounts for Trump's turnabout? Money, of course. Turns out, the owner of a competing bridge between Windsor and Detroit is a trucking billionaire named Matthew Maroon. He met with Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick Monday, and Trump made his threat hours later. The mayor of Windsor called Trump's comments insane, and Senator Elisa Slotkin, Democrat of Michigan, said Trump's threats to tank the bridge project meant he was, quote, punishing Michiganders for a trade war he started, unquote. Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary, countered that Trump is merely putting America's interests first. Next, there were two important elections in Asia last week. In Japan, Prime Minister Takeuchi Senae won a resounding victory just a little over 3 months into her position. She took a chance that voters were ready for a more tough-minded approach to the economy and to national security, meaning China. Her Liberal Democratic Party won an absolute majority in the lower house of the Diet, or parliament, the first time that has happened in many decades. She'll be able to push through her agenda with little opposition. And in Thailand, the conservative ruling party easily won, ensuring the continuation of nationalist, royalist, pro-military policies. The opposition's pro-democracy stance, which had been expected to prevail, was defeated. Thailand's border war with Cambodia evidently was a factor in the ruling party's favor. Finally, one update from Hong Kong. Jimmy Lai, the media mogul whose Apple Daily was a constant thorn in the side of the People's Republic, was sentenced to 20 years in prison on trumped-up charges of sedition. He has already spent the last 5 years in detention, and this latest ruling will be a death sentence since he is 78. As the New York Times reports, quote, the decision reached far beyond one man's fate. Along with Mr. Lai, six of his former employees at the shuttered Apple Daily newspaper were sentenced to terms of up to 10 years, establishing a grim new benchmark for the city's once freewheeling media. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
Hello out there, this is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of the OCA, Walt Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric, and police departments telling you what you should listen to, stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored, non-commercial